This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
kboo.org. I want to welcome Emily Jensen to the studio tonight. Emily is a graduate student in multimedia journalism at the University of Oregon in Portland. She is a freelancer for the Willamette Week and an activist. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you.
Tonight, we talk about art and prison. Emily and I interviewed Jackie Summel a few weeks ago. Jackie is an artist and activist who lives in New Orleans, Louisiana. She's been communicating with Herman Wallace, one of the Angola Three, incarcerated in Louisiana and on solitary confinement for over 40 years. In 2003, artist Jackie asked Herman a very simple question. What kind of house does a man who's lived in a 6-foot by 9-foot box for over 30 years dream of? The answer to the question has become a remarkable project, principled in, quote, social sculpture, community outreach, benevolence, and the ultimate power of the imagination cult, the house that Hurtman built, end of quote. This extraordinary collaboration between Jackie and Herman Wallace has gained international recognition through its exhibition and corresponding book. Before we go to the interview with Jackie Summel, Emily, can you talk about how you met Jackie in New Orleans and some of the work that you did with her?
Yeah, three friends and I were going to school in Los Angeles, and we decided to take a weekend trip to New Orleans by car. Which is 32 hours both ways.
Wow.
So, yeah, so we planned to stay with my friend Sarah's friend, Jackie, who I had never met before. So we drove 32 hours straight. We didn't stop. We just went in shifts. And I actually remember meeting Jackie on a street corner in Uptown New Orleans outside the yoga studio that she was teaching at the time. And then we went in and she did, like, just was immediately super warm. And did a restorative, like, post-traumatic car syndrome yoga session. And then she let us stay at her house. And I remember, if I remember right, she, like, let us sleep in her bed. She didn't even know us. She was just extremely welcoming and someone who just will connect with you immediately. So that's how I met Jackie initially. And then... that was in the fall. In the winter that year, I went with other students from my college to stay with Jackie and work with her on the Angola 3 activism that she does, which is on behalf of Herman Wallace as well as the two other prisoners who are a part of the Angola 3. So it was, I think, 9 of us. Again, she opened her home to us. And she, her house in the 7th Ward in New Orleans is meant to be open to activists and kids in the community. So we stayed with her for 3 weeks and slept on the floor and worked on all different projects for the Angola 3.
And why are prison issues really important to you?
When I first heard about the Angola 3 through Jackie's lens, she comes at it with such compassion and sort of the idea that all humans have a vested interest in what happens to other humans. And that's been inspiring for me. So any work that I've done from here on out, that's kind of the way that I look at it, is that, you know, if you know that something bad is happening to someone else, regardless of how far apart your experiences may be, you know, there's no reason why you shouldn't want to help them or want to try to understand them better and see what you can do about it.
And I'm sure at this point, listener, you might be wondering who the Angola 3 are, but Jackie is going to go over who they are, three men in a penitentiary in New Orleans. And just to let you know how Jackie Summel is connected, she actually knows our own Jenkins Soderbergh, our PM news director here at KBOO. So without further ado, let's go to this interview that Emily Jensen and myself conducted with Jackie Summel. That was a few weeks ago.
Could you tell us first, who are the Angola 3?
The Angola 3 are three men who are identified as their political belief system and also their history, being the longest-serving solitary confinement inmates at Angola Prison in Louisiana. They are Herman Wallace, Albert Woodcox, and Robert King.
And how did you come to hear about the Angola 3?
I met the Angola 3 through the only free member, Robert King. He was released February 8th, 2001, after serving 29 years of solitary confinement, 31 years of wrongful imprisonment in Angola Prison in Louisiana. And he was basically doing a very small, very modest tour, and he came to San Francisco where I was living. And so I met him initially, and then he sort of pointed me in the direction of the others, Herman Wallace and Albert Woodcox.
And did you decide to move to Louisiana based on your encounter with him?
It's a little more complicated than that. I moved to Louisiana because of the work I was doing, advocacy work on behalf of the Angola 3. But I also came to post-Katrina New Orleans and, you know, really had this life-changing experience where my sort of couch, easy chair, couch, whatever, liberal views were put to the test, and and I was engaged as an activist for the first time. I was very active. And so it was a life-changing experience in the face of great tragedy. And so I stayed.
How would you say, like, what was that transformation from going from being, like, a couch liberal to experiencing post-Katrina New Orleans? And then, you know, like, what changed about the way that you see activism?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's being informed and being active are two really different things. That when you live in a liberal refugee camp like San Francisco, you don't really recognize because everyone's patting you on the back for talking about Noam Chomsky, right? And so all of that is really important foundational work, understanding what's important to you, understanding the politics behind your action. But acting is a vital part of identifying as an activist.
And how do you use your art as a form of activism?
I mean, for me, there's really no distinction between the categories of my life, the big sister category, the godmother category, the artist, the activist. You know, none of those have very structural walls between them. They all kind of morph into each other, and that's a really important part of my identity. So when I found, or when I met Robert King, and I found something that I thought was incredibly moving and challenging and something I found to be impossible and I needed to act on it, I used the tools I had, right? I used the tools that I had accessible. And at that time, I was an MFA student at Stanford University. And so my art began to speak my mind, you know, began to speak my passion. And that passion is, some people would say, is considered within the walls of activism.
Can you describe a little bit more how, after you heard Robert King, what were some of the actions that you took to get in contact with Herman Wallace and Albert Woodcox, who were still incarcerated?
Sure. I mean, I often tell the story of meeting Robert King on a pretty typical day in San Francisco, you know, gray, rainy, et cetera, and I had no idea who he was, and I wasn't doing any organizing in terms of the prison industrial complex or wrongful imprisonment, nothing like that. I had no vocabulary, but I did have a crush on one of the organizers, so I decided to go to this lecture that he was organizing, and on the way there, I got cut off by some SUV, and I, like, jumped off my bicycle and started screaming at the SUV about being, you know, this gas guzzling, beep, 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 whatever. And just, like, totally lost my cool. And then I went into the lecture, and I heard this man talk about spending 29 years in solitary confinement for a crime he didn't commit. And he was a lot less angry than I was for something as stupid as getting cut off on, you know, on the side of the road. And I just felt like I had something to learn from him. You know, I needed to pay attention to this man's prophecy, to this man's existence. And at the end of the lecture, I asked him, what could I do? You know, I have no idea. I have no vocabulary. And he said, just write my comrades. And I started writing Herman Wallace and Albert Wood Fox in 2001.
What do you feel that they get out of letters that they receive?
When you're kept in a 6-foot by 9-foot box for 23 hours a day for 40 years, your access to the world is really, really limited. You know, they have very little decision-making power in terms of what they can watch on television. They have very little decision-making power in terms of when they turn their lights on and off. The prison is in charge of all of that. And so the letters that they get are very precious because they are, you know, picture windows to other people's lives, people living outside of prison walls. And I know that it's been some of the most valuable contact has come through letter writing to Herman and Albert.
How did you feel the first time you received a letter back from one of them?
The first letter I got was from Herman, and he's a very prolific writer. Albert is a little bit more reserved. And the first time I got a letter from him, it was a really emotional experience. You know, I felt like I was being contacted by the unknown and that I was being contacted by the impossible. This man who at that time had been in solitary confinement for 29 years, and I was only 28 years old, right? So contextualizing my entire life, he was in solitary confinement. Hmm. And then he wrote me this very personable and kind letter, you know, and it was this moving experience. I mean, there's so much strength in their ability to just remain human, in their ability to just remain present in the world.
And what was the first letter that you sent to them look like? What did it? What did you have in it?
Yeah, I had absolutely no idea what to write them. And so the first letter I wrote them, I just had strapped a disposable camera to my wrist, and I set my watch alarm to beep every hour, and every hour I took a picture of whatever was in front of me. So 6 or 7 of those photographs were like various angles of my bed or my toes or whatever when I was sleeping, and then the rest of them were kind of these pictures that most of us would throw away. And Herman and Albert were both so engaged and grateful because they had never seen like a close-up of a dashboard, you know. Or at one point I was jogging and along the Riverwalk in San Francisco, and it was kind of like just this encounter with another runner, you know, and this other runner's like waist and hand and whatever else, and things that, like I said, most of us would throw away, and for them was very precious.
And so fast forward, I'm not actually sure how many years, but you ended up starting a project with Herman called The House That Herman Built. Could you tell us about it?
Yeah, from there, fast forward about 2 years. And I actually just started asking Herman to dream. It wasn't intended to be a project. It came out of an assignment that I was given at Stanford. And I asked him what kind of house he dreams of after spending 29 years in solitary confinement. And, you know, he sort of, at first, he poo-pooed the idea and was just like, I don't dream about a house. You know, I'm a revolutionary. I dream about fighting in the hills of Mexico and not participating in this, like, capitalist campaign to own homes and titleship, et cetera, you know. And then I sort of reminded him that he was 60 years old, and he might want to think about dreaming of a house for when he does get out, you know. And so we began there. And, yeah, and 11 years later, I'm living in New Orleans and hoping to build his dream home here.
And what would his dream home look like? I think that maybe it would be a good time to mention your website and how people can go and actually see a little short movie animation of what his house looked like. And can you mention your website and then maybe describe like a room or something very specific about the house that Herman wants?
Sure. You can actually, you can see a lot of stills from not only Herman's drawings, but the CAD video fly-through at my website, which is hermanshouse.org. And his house is, I mean, it's pretty traditional. You know, he's kind of been kept in a box for 40 years, and that has sort of relegated his imagination to memory from when he was free, so 40 years ago. So he's designed a very simple A-frame home with a porch and ton of windows and, you know, a few of the sort of nuances that indicate that he's been in solitary confinement and under siege for so long. He's asked that the whole house be made of wood so that he could set it afire if he ever needed to escape, you know, if he was under attack. And he has an escape chute to an underground tunnel built into the house, which is remarkable and which is indicative of 40 years of torture. But, you know, outside of that, the house itself is normalized, you know, in a lot of ways. It's sort of this manifestation of American society's collective subconscious. You know, it's an A-framed house with a ton of gardens. He's got multiple guest rooms and a big old kitchen, and he's a swimming pool in the back and a little house for out-of-state activists. yeah, it's pretty beautiful.
And there's a lot of flowers. He wants a lot of flowers everywhere.
The first thing he asked for was flowers, and he goes into great detail about the flowers that he wants and how he wants to be able to grow flowers all year long. You know, how he wants to be able to have a greenhouse and to be able to keep life inside and outside of the house, because he's been inside concrete and steel for 40 years.
So in addition to writing to Herman, you've also visited him plenty of times, and I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about Angola and what it's like inside from your perspective and what you can see.
Yeah, I mean, I've been visiting Herman all now for 10 years, over 10 years, and he's since moved from Angola prison to Hunt, but he's remained in solitary confinement, or they've kept him in solitary confinement. Angola, where he spent 38 years of his now 41 years of solitary, is the largest prison in America, the former slave plantation, named for the place in Africa where they thought the most profitable slaves came from. It's completely like time travel. You know, it's totally anachronic. You enter the grounds of Angola, there's a bunch of black men basically working on a chain gang, working the fields with white men on horses with guns. And, you know, it has a 5,000 prisoner population, about 5,000 men, and 80% of them are black. The upper administration is all white. It's a completely surreal experience. I think what hit me first the first time I went to visit was the smell. I mean, it smells like, if you could put a smell to torture, I feel like it would smell like Angola.
Wow.
Can you talk a little bit about how Herman ended up there and maybe why he was in solitary confinement or has been in solitary confinement for so many years?
He ended up in Angola for armed robbery. You know, which in the 1970s, many black men to this day are still in prison because of this system of, quote-unquote, clearing the books, you know, just needing to find an answer to a particular crime. So Herman was in there initially for armed robbery, and while serving his sentence for armed robbery, he started to get politicized. And he actually saw what the Black Panthers were doing around the United States, but particularly in New Orleans, you know, and he started to educate himself. And within Angola, Herman Wallace, Albert Wilcox, and Robert King started the first chapter of the Black Panther Party inside a prison where they targeted this egregious rape trade that was happening they basically changed the face of the prison, which at that time was segregated, racially segregated. It was the most violent prison in America. You know, they taught prisoners how to read. They assuaged a lot of the racial tensions. Like I said, they changed the shape of the prison, which was really costly to the state of Louisiana. And as a result, they clamped down. And on April 17th, 1972, a prison guard by the name of Brent Miller was murdered. He was stabbed 32 times and left to die in Camp A in the prison. And nobody saw who did it, right? There was no eyewitnesses. And it's a prison, so most people know where their prisoners are. And they're not just wandering around freely. And nonetheless, this prison guard was brutally murdered. No one saw it happen. 48 hours later, a prisoner came forward named Hezekiah Brown and said, "Oh, I know who it was. It was Herman Wallace, Albert Fox, and Robert King." And Hezekiah Brown had his sentence commuted for possessing the bravery to testify against his peers. He also received a carton of cigarettes, $100, I think, every month. So he was paid by prison officials to testify against Herman and Albert. And Robert King was actually in a totally different prison at the time of the murder, but he spent 29 years in solitary confinement under investigation for the murder of Brent Miller.
Can you describe a little bit what solitary confinement entails?
This is such an important question. I think we as a society have to face the reality of what solitary confinement is. You know, it's interesting because the UN and the international community has statutes defining solitary confinement, but the United States does not per se. So you run into problems because you have different names for the same experience, right? So in Angola, Louisiana, the solitary confinement is CCR, closed cell restriction. Their death row is also solitary cells, individual cells. We have no human contact unless you are being handcuffed to come out of the cell, and that's for a minimum of 23 hours a day. In states like California, they call it the SHU. People have heard this before. Sometimes it's called the hole, ADSEG, administrative segregation, you know, et cetera. So there's a lot of different names for the same experience, and because of that, it makes it hard. It makes it hard to identify as a social problem, right? You know, as a problem within the prison system, because everyone's calling it something different. So, for instance, you say to the Attorney General Buddy Caldwell here in the state of Louisiana, "You can't keep men in solitary confinement for 41 years. That's cruel and unusual punishment." And he says, "Solitary confinement, it's closed cell restriction. It's not solitary." Mm-hmm. And that becomes an issue within the legal context as well.
This river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know change has gotta come now. Ooh, yes it is now. Oh my. It's been too hard living. Oh, and I'm afraid to die. I don't know what's up there beyond the clouds. It's been a long time coming. I know change has gotta come. Oh yes it is. There's a time I will go to my brother. Oh, man.
asked my brother, will you help me leave? He turned me down, and then I asked my dear mother, oh, I said, mother, I'm down on my knees. Somehow I thought I was still labor to try to carry on. It's been a long time coming that I know a change is gonna come. Oh, yes it is. Just like I said, I went to my little bitty brother. Oh, my little brother now. I asked my brother, brother, help me please. Oh, now. He turned me down, and then I go to my little mother, my dear mother. Oh, my.
You're listening to Bread and Roses. I am Delphine Crescenzo, and I'm here with Emily Jensen. We just finished listening to Otis Redding. This is his take of A Change Is Gonna Come, originally by Sam Cooke, in honor of the Angola 3 and of the work that Jackie is doing. But also, I like to play this song a lot because a change does need to happen. And this is what we are trying to bring you this interview, because Jackie Sommel is artist and activist down in New Orleans, and what she is doing is really trying to bring a change through awareness. So she conversed and exchanged correspondence with Herman Wallace, who has been in solitary confinement for about 40 years and has been incarcerated for about as long. And she asked him, what kind of a house do you dream of? And so this is the story that she is telling us. In the second part of the interview, we ask her about some of the visits that she had with Herman at his current location, still in a penitentiary in Louisiana. Let's go to that part.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the psychological trauma that is left on the man, even, I would say, after a few hours of solitary confinement, let alone after 30 years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, most people go crazy after about 8 hours of solitary confinement. There's some cases that are just going now, being pushed forward by the ACLU. One in particular was an 18-year-old boy who was in jail for a DUI, and I think this is in Idaho, and so he's 18 years old, he goes to jail for a DUI, and he spends, I think it was 2 weeks in solitary confinement, and then he came out, he was released back to general pop, and he got in an argument with his cellmate, and they said, we're going to split you up and put you guys back into solitary confinement, and the trauma of the 2 weeks in solitary confinement was too much for this kid to bear, and within 8 minutes of being in his solitary cell, he killed himself. And it's indicative of the effects of solitary confinement. I mean, Mississippi eradicated 80% of their solitary cells with the understanding that 75% of the prison population is released at some point. And when you put somebody in solitary confinement, you're basically making them insane, right? You're turning them into a monster. You're putting them into unbearable conditions, and very often for minor infractions.
What types of things have Herman and Albert done to cope with that for 40 years, for such an long time?
I think the most important thing that Herman and Albert have done, their means of survival, is that they understand that they are not doing this for themselves. There's a much greater and bigger purpose in their lives. And the deeper that they are buried, the stronger they become. You know, they understand that if they're able to endure this kind of torture, they may ensure that no one else has to do it. And that gives them the strength to keep going.
And how is the prison at this point justifying having both of them in solitary confinement still?
I mean, there's different layers here. So there's the Department of Corrections, and then there's a legal wing, right? There's the Attorney General, who's claiming that it's not actually solitary confinement, but it's a 6-foot by 9-foot cell, where they're forced to stay with a toilet, a very mediocre version of a bed, and a small desk. And it's, you know, they're forced to stay there a minimum of 23 hours a day. They get out 3 times a week to go in the yard by themselves. And the other days they are out for 50 minutes to be able to take a shower. So, you know, you have on one end the legal, the justice, quote-unquote justice department, saying, well, that's not solitary. And that's how they excuse themselves from accountability. The DOC, Department of Corrections, has said in the past that they're kept there for their own safety. They've then excused themselves and said they've been kept there because they're a threat to other prisoners, because they're such powerful organizers. And then at a different point in time, you know, they've said they were kept there because of their Black Pantherism. This is Burl Cain, the warden at Angola, who said they were kept in solitary because of their Black Pantherism, you know, which is a political prisoner. And the U.S., by statute, does not have political prisoners. You can't have a political prisoner in a democracy.
My understanding is that in Louisiana, the governing bodies are so intertwined and generally corrupt that it's hard to challenge them.
Yeah, Louisiana is a good old boy state. You know, we are the harshest sentencing state in the country. You know, the city of New Orleans has the highest prison population per capita of any place in the world. Louisiana likes to lock up their population, you know, and there's very little visible places that you to empower yourself, right, to fight against a system that incarcerates predominantly poor people of color. And Angola has operated with impunity, you know, for 200 years. And it's really hard to get inside the walls, you know. I mean, I feel like people are becoming more and more educated in terms of what it means, what the prison industrial complex means. They're getting more and more educated on what are the, like, what is the outcome of the war on drugs. They're becoming more and more educated on how this affects us, like those of us who aren't incarcerated as a whole, what it means to have this subclass of people coming out of prison and re-entering society, right? And what that means for the things that are valuable to those of us who are not incarcerated.
I think that there's also the idea that prison, we're not supposed to be punitive, but a way to bring people back into our community with, like, you know, a change of heart, because these were supposed to be, you know, criminals and all that. I have the feeling that prisons are definitely more punitive these days. When you keep someone in solitary confinement for 30 years, that sounds like a punishment to me.
Yeah, I mean, the word penitentiary comes from the root is like to seek penance, like to think about your crime. Solitary confinement was initially created by the Quakers, which is kind of interesting because now there's a huge Quaker movement to end solitary confinement, you know, because they recognize that it's torture. But it was started in Pennsylvania, and the idea was that people would be thrown into these dark, dingy solitary cells with one hole at the top where they would learn how to speak to God, basically. They would find God, right? Penitence. Mm. And that's the root word for the penitentiary. Yeah. I don't think that the U.S. penal system was ever designed to rehabilitate or reintegrate. You know, for me, I am of the understanding through my education and my experience that, you know, the U.S. penal system is designed to create a subclass of people, right, to keep people in a permanent state of having to work for the state, of neo-slavery. And, you know, and I feel like if there was a system that rehabilitated prisoners, we would never have this large of a population. We would never have the recidivism rates that we have in the United States, which are the highest in the world, you know. If we were actually educating and rehabilitating prisoners, they would be able to come back and function within a healthy society, a normalized society, like they do in many, many other countries.
I have the feeling also that when you say to someone, I'm going to rehabilitate you, you are already making a statement that something is wrong with you, not that something is wrong with society, or that, you know, you were born the poorest of the poor and you ended up having to commit armed robbery in order, you know, to survive. So I just feel that there's a lot of pressure that's being put on the people versus, you know, us as a society taking responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's no shame with rehab. You know, I feel like I am a middle-class American, and I'm like, I have access to rehabilitation in a lot of ways, right? Like, in terms of therapy, in terms of the privilege of going to seek yoga or whatever it is, mm-hmm. you know, it's to rehabilitate some part of my life that was wounded. You know, there's a giant or a growing, it's not giant by any means, but there's a growing restorative justice movement, which is this kind of marriage with rehabilitation and also allowing inmates to acknowledge, or prisoners, convicted prisoners, to acknowledge the crimes they committed, and restoring the justice, which involves very often the victim's families, depending on the crime. And within that, the sort of restoration is not only of like their past experience or their past crime, you know, it's a restoration of the same things that any one of us would want or need to restore, you know, any of the damage that we all accrue from childhood into mm-hmm. adulthood, you know. And some of us have access to heal that stuff, to restore it, and some of us don't. You know,
can you describe to us like a visit to see him? Or where do you guys sit? What do you talk about?
Sure. Yeah. Herman is now at Elaine Hunt Correctional Facility in St. Gabriel, Louisiana. It's just outside of Baton Rouge, and it's a maximum security penitentiary. He's still kept in solitary confinement. We have a system with a visiting shed where it's Herman is kept with leg shackles but he doesn't have arm shackles. And you meet with him at a table. There's an armed guard who sits in the room with you. Herman just advocated and organized to ensure that there would be hot food served, because we used to only be able to buy stuff from the vending machine. There's something so simple and just so, let me think of the right word, civilized. There's something so civilized about being able to eat a meal with a person. So that really changes the dynamic a lot. If it's Herman and I visiting, generally one of us is screaming throughout the entire visit.
Screaming?
Arguing about anything from the Saints lineup to, like, death penalty prosecution, you know. But it's a very somber atmosphere. I would say 90% of those folks getting visits are Black. You know, it's Louisiana. There's a small population of Latinos. And then, you know, there's very, very few white folks in the prison incarcerated that are visiting. So you get a real sense of like who's being incarcerated when you the first time you visit your you visit someone in jail.
How many other people are in the room with you?
Oh, it just depends. It's not a lot. It depends who's getting a visitor that day. So it could be usually up to 10 or 15.
Okay.
But sometimes it's just Herman and I.
And what do you have to go through in order to visit him?
It's super random. I mean, there's a metal detector, there's a pat-down, and sometimes they do a second pat-down. Sometimes they'll say, like, you know, your clothes, you can't wear that because of whatever arbitrary reason that, you know, they put forward. It just depends what kind of mood they're in. So, like, they'll say to one woman, you can't go in with those pants because they're too tight. And then the next woman will be wearing the same pants and they'll let her pass through, right? It's just a very arbitrary process. It makes visiting super hard.
So does that mean that then this woman has to leave or go change her pants
yeah.
and then come back?
She has to leave, and then they kind of encourage her. This must be like, this is sort of a capitalist society. There's a Dollar General down the block, and so they can go get, you know, a new pair of pants at the Dollar General. And my roommate had a really interesting experience. She's on Herman's visiting list, and she went in one day, and they decided that her shirt didn't cover the belt buckle of her pants or something, and so like if she raised her arms you could see her belly, and she was like, oh, that's ridiculous, you know. And they were like, ma'am, you have to put on another shirt. And she was like, or a higher pair of pants. So she went to her car and she happened to have like a Dayglo orange rubber shrimping suit put on. And she went back in, and they were just like, get out of here, you know? And she was like, what? You can't see my belly, you know? And then it just became this whole exchange, and she finally had to go to the Dollar General and get a size triple X sweatshirt comparing to visit Herman.
Wow.
I will say there are some beautiful things that happen, though. You know, it's... we're all in this together, right? And there's been moments where I've seen older women offer a younger woman her jacket or something that she has in the car. I personally have given folks T-shirts that I just keep in my car in case there's any issue with what I'm wearing. You know, people look out for each other in the face of, you know, the trauma of going into a prison, and that in and of itself is a pretty beautiful experience.
And what did it take to end up on Herman's visiting list?
Herman's only allowed 10 people on his visiting list, and so they go through, you know, the whole background check and whatever else. It's a big pain to get on the visiting list, and then, he's only allowed 10 folks. Same with Albert. One of the things that's worth mentioning is that Angola just instituted a new policy that anyone who's in CCR, TU, blood relatives on their visiting list, which is cruel and unusual. So you can't have any friends, or if you're not married to a person, they cannot be on your visiting list. It is awful.
I'm glad they're not there anymore. Where is Albert?
Albert is at David Wade Correctional Facility up in Homer, Louisiana. He's about 6.5 hours away from New Orleans. He's really hard to visit. And his visiting conditions are much worse than Herman's, are much worse than when he was at Angola. It's really, really an intense experience. I'd actually say that David Wade is, out of the three that I've mentioned, is the worst facility. I mean, it's just very disorganized. They have a lot fewer amenities in terms of, you know, when you visit with him, he's shackled ankles and wrists. They have no hot food. You're in a tiny, tiny room with many, many people, a lot more than you would be at Hunt. The visits are shorter. You know, I can visit Herman for 8 hours on a Sunday. I can drive 6.5 hours each way and only visit with Woodfox for 2 hours. Which is awful. Yeah, it's a remarkably disorganized prison, and he is in the protective custody unit, which is absurd. So he's on a prison block with, like, the police officers from the Denzinger Bridge, and he's on the same unit as, like, you know, judges and cops and attorneys and people who are in protective custody, you know.
And can you talk about how Albert Woodfolk's ruling was recently overturned for the third time, and what does that mean?
So Albert Woodfolk's conviction was overturned for a third time by Judge Brady, a federal court judge. And, it's an amazing decision. It illustrates the travesty of justice. This was the third time he's had his conviction overturned. And now he could be up for bail within the next 30 days, which is also really exciting. And we are just asking the state of Louisiana not to appeal, right? It's hundreds of thousands of dollars have been wasted continuing to persecute and prosecute this man. He is 66 years old. He spent 41 years in solitary confinement, and he's been ruled innocent by a court three times. He's had his conviction overturned, and the state continues to appeal it.
So, have there been any new developments since we spoke about 2 weeks ago?
There's no new developments. I mean, the state has 30 days to file its appeal, and so we and Amnesty International have asked people to sign up online. Amnesty still has the petition online, and we've asked people to sign the petition, which goes straight to the Attorney General Buddy Caldwell's office and says, please stop wasting your money and prosecuting Albert Woodfolk.
How about Herman? Is there any hope or anything happening right now around his case and hope for release one day?
Herman has a habeas filed with a federal court, Judge Jackson, and so we are waiting patiently 2 years for Judge Jackson to review Herman's habeas. So he's also in a similar situation where he can overturn Herman's conviction.
If people were interested in being of any help to the case of both Herman and Albert, what would you tell them to do? What would be most effective?
In terms of organizing around Herman and Albert, I'd say right now, sign the Amnesty petition. You can just go on the Amnesty International website and Google, or they have like a little search engine, Angola 3. I think that is a critical mass that is required. Also, just getting online and looking at the Angola 3 website, educating yourself so that you can speak intelligently about it. I mean, it's a complicated case. It's a complicated situation. You want to be able to know your own facts, right? And you can also order this film called In the Land of the Free and host the film screening, which talks about injustice, talks about their cases. It's a documentary film. There's a lot of different things that you can do, but you start with being informed, and then once you're informed, if you're moved or if you're inspired or if you are aggravated, then you act.
Something that I mean, like, for anyone who happens to listen and wants to do some kind of action, something that we got to do when we were working with Jackie while I was in school is like representations of the size of the cells that Herman and Albert are held in. So we would do, like, I think we call them tape cell interventions.
So yeah, you know, and I think that that's also like a very effective action. But I think the operative word is action. It's like whether or not you put Who is Herman Wallace stickers on every garbage can in your neighborhood, or you paint a giant canvas that says Free the Angle of the Three, you know, you wear a button, you create these cells, right? You host a film screening. You bring my film or you bring my project to your school. Whatever it is that you do something, right?
Mm-hmm. Can you talk actually about how would it be possible to bring your project somewhere? Because there is the website, but there is also a living exhibit. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the living exhibit is a traveling exhibition. We are actually looking to bring it to New York and San Francisco in the next year, and or somewhere in California in the next year. It's really just a matter of contacting myself, and then I can get the wheels rolling with some of the gallery folks who are holding on to it right now.
Thank you so much, Jackie. Is there anything else that you wanted to add?
All
power to the people is what she said. We just finished listening to an interview with Jackie Semmel. She is an artist and activist in New Orleans, discussing the art project that she collaborated on with Herman Wallace, who's lived in solitary confinement for 40 years. And the project is called The House That Herman Built. You can go to www.hermanshouse.org. That's HERMANSHOUSE, hermanshouse.org, to read more about the project and to see the interactive video actually of Herman's house. I'm here with Emily Jensen. We both conducted this interview. Emily, Jackie is your friend, and you just spoke to her recently. I just blanked for a second. Can you talk about, and she actually experienced the shooting on Mother's Day last Sunday in New Orleans. I was wondering if you can talk a little bit about that and how that relates with her work on compassion.
Yeah, definitely. So for those who don't know, because it was not covered widely in the national media, there was a shooting during a Mother's Day parade in New Orleans in Jackie's neighborhood, which is the 7th Ward. And we talked on the phone this week, and she said that she was in the parade at the front and heard the shots. So 19, I think 20 people now is the count, were hit. No one died. But she ran to the back and just saw bodies, injured bodies. And so I think this is important to point out, or just to bring up, because the work that she does with the Angola 3 is all about compassion for other people. And when situations like this or incidents like this happen, it's important to approach them with compassion for everyone involved, including the perpetrator. And something to think about with the shooter in this situation is he was a 19-year-old who would have been 12 during Hurricane Katrina, and coping with PTSD. Most likely, although that's not confirmed. But it just, you know, reminds us to approach issues with compassion and think about the human aspect.
Absolutely. And then, you know, come up with such amazing collaborative work of art that Jackie and Herman both put together. Again, hermanshouse.org is the website. She also mentioned in the interview signing a petition to help Herman leave prison, and that's on the Amnesty International website. There was also a documentary made about her documenting, her making this, and I believe you were trying to bring this to town, so stay tuned about that. Well, thank you, Emily, for partnering with me on that interview, and I hope you will consider collaborating on other projects in the future.
Duh.
Thank you, all of you, for listening to Bread and Roses. Next week, Della Ray will be your host, and she will bring you more about self-care. That's her thing. Check out our website, kboo.fm/breadandroses. Listen to past shows, post comments, show ideas, and also like us on Facebook, KBOO Bread and Roses. Of course, if you're interested in joining the Bread and Roses collective of women host engineers and producers, please email Ani Haynes, KBOO's volunteer coordinator, at volunteer@kboo.org. Thank you, Danielle, for engineering tonight, and have a wonderful evening, everyone. I will leave you with the Digging Roots. This is Plant a Seed.
Have you heard about the Melting Pot Silent Mobile Dance Parties?
Silent dance? Doesn't sound very fun.
Actually, it's a lot of fun. Picture 200 people dancing with headphones to the same music. The Melting Pot Radio Show will have a series of silent dance parties from 8 to 10 p.m. Tuesdays in Portland parks and public spaces. That's Tuesdays from 8 to 10 p.m. For more information and this week's location, go to kboo.fm/silent dance parties.
Pride Northwest Incorporated is proud to announce its 2013 official Pride schedule of events for June 9th through 16th. We have a full week of exciting happenings designed to showcase and celebrate the LGBTQ community, including a Star Trek theme party, a special film screening, a comedy showcase, and a Tony Award-winning musical. The week will conclude with the 43rd annual Portland Pride Waterfront Festival and Parade, June 15th and 16th at Tom McCall Park. More information about the Portland Pride Festival and Parade can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
You know, for a lot of people that's listening, a little bit of background about yourself. Many people knew you for years as a writer.
Yes.
And the stereotype is that frustrated MCs become writers. Were you a frustrated writer who became an MC?
I think that anybody who's a writer is frustrated. I mean, editorial never gets any love. Authors don't get any love. And I'm just a weird hybrid because I think I was a performer first, and then I became a writer thinking I would never be a female MC. You know, I think every female MC has a backup plan. And I've mentioned it before. We don't all just do one thing, and it's because we have this thought in our head that this is not going to last forever. So it's good because it brings a certain perspective to my work that while I'm here, I'm not here to struggle to stay relevant. I'm here to really tell you my message as of right now, and hopefully that's going to lead to some change.
Do you have a backup plan?
yeah, school. Journalism was my first career, and now that's my backup plan, and now that's my plan Z. So basically, I really just, as a writer, you have to really be resilient in this economy, whether it's going from the internet, from print to the internet, from the internet to a studio, or from a studio to a classroom. So at the end of the day, my message is always going to be whatever it is I carry wherever I go.
We're talking with Rocky Rivera. We're hanging out with her this afternoon. She got a brand new mixtape. We're going to listen to songs off that tape in a minute. One of the questions, you know, and I brought up the fact that you're a writer, a journalist. Is it hard for you to make the transition as a writer, journalist, to somebody who pens lyrics? You know, do you get caught up in editing yourself? Do you overanalyze your message? You know, I mean, because they're two different disciplines.
And not to mention that I pissed quite a few bloggers off in my day as a young journalist coming up. So I have to deal with that now. I have to be friends with them because I'm like, hey, remember me? I called you out for not having any street cred out. Can you put my song in your blog?
Did you really? Did you used to do that?
You know, I think that any situation where you feel like you're a minority in a profession where there should be more people that look just like you, that act like you, you kind of have like this complex. You have a complex about wanting to break through. Any young person who makes it to the level that I made it, of course, is going to be angry about the situation because nobody else looks like them, nobody else sounds like them, and it's almost treated like a novelty. I think that anger has served me well now that I'm an artist because they can understand that it's in a context and it's just not on some, you know, some bull trying to provoke another journalist. But it's funny because I'm a writer, but I have all the aggression of the hip-hop community, all the anger, the mistrust of authority of an MC, so I think that they go hand in hand.
Let's take a listen to a song off the brand new mixtape, Pop Killer. You're taking out the pop artists. Is that, are you going after the Lady Gagas of the world and what have you?
You know what? I wanted to challenge pop as well as use pop to get my message across because an artist who writes the kind of music that I write, which is challenging the norms and what's going on in society, that's the message that really should be spread throughout the world. You know, pop doesn't have a message. Pop is ridicule. Pop is outrageous. Pop is just ignorant garbage. And for some reason, it's the common denominator. Instead of really having an informed democracy, an informed readership, and at the same time, I wanted to show people that I can have fun. And whatever it is that I look like, whatever medium it is that I use, at the end of the day, it's all about the message.
Should we start off with Girls?
Girls. Girls is a crazy song. It's so much fun. The Jacka actually let us use one of his beats from Tear Gas. It is a playoff of the BC Boys original, and I really wanted to use it because I do have an all-girl rock band, DJ Rose and Ivory Eyes. Shout out to y'all.
We'll be right back.